Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the China Shop, home of the Band of Traders podcast. I am your host, Kyle, and today I've got a special guest, Eric Mason, CFO of Quinzy. Always hit that Z, otherwise you get a lot of angry letters. How you doing, Eric?
Doing very good, Kyle. How you doing, sir?
Excellent, man. I heard you just finished your 2025 Outlook meeting, which sounds like it went pretty well.
Yeah, no, it was a great time, and again, I really want to thank Gray Associates out in Canton, Mass, for bringing me back for a second year to be able to talk to their, talk to their clients, talk to their team, and give an outlook on 2025. You know, it's funny. It was a snowy day.
Yeah.
And still had 150 people show up. So it was. We had a blast. They did an excellent job, the whole team out there.
What was the best reaction you got through the whole? Did you get any questions? Did you get anybody coming up to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's always fun. I mean, I enjoy talking about economics, as you know, as Cal unfortunately knows how much I like talking about economics.
I love talking about economics too, though.
Cal, you are a very natural economist, by the way, man. You really are. You got that good. I always say economics is a mindset, not an education. You got that.
Yeah, definitely don't have the education, but
life experience is more education. That's why I'm an Austrian,
right?
So we ended up doing about an hour and a half long, or hour. Hour 15 presentation, another 20 minutes of Q&A, everything from cryptocurrency and blockchains to nuclear energy to immigration policy.
Did I hear you made light of Chernobyl at one point?
Oh yeah, that was that'll be fun when that gets edited. I got asked a question by a gentleman. Actually, Kyle, this is kind of in your world on the what you used to do on the manufacturing side. I know you know this, but I don't think a lot of people realize just how much raw energy it takes to do anything in manufacturing.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I got asked a question by one of the gentlemen in the audience that said, do you think the rise of nuclear is inevitable? And I said, well, what does nuclear energy do? It produces a ton of clean water and a ton of energy, which are the two things you need to make chips and to cool down data centers. I then also talked a little bit about thorium. I don't know if a lot of people know this, but the thorium reactors are kind of the new reactors that are coming along. India's done a bunch of, I covered this in my outlook in terms for the energy sector. But the big thing to watch over the next couple of years is thorium. The Indians have been really big on developing thorium reactors because they don't have a lot of uranium and not a lot of hydrocarbons, especially for a place with 1.4 billion people. And the U.S. just passed, I believe it was in September, it might have been August, a thorium reserve bill that basically increased the amount of uranium-232, which is the precursor for thorium.
Mm-hmm.
Thorium is as common in the Earth's crust as lead. And generally speaking, cannot go critical. So I think that'll be a big... But I pointed out, Chernobyl...
Wait, hold on. Gonna use the word critical correctly here. Critical just means a self-sustaining nuclear reaction. What that means is you're producing as many neutrons as you're absorbing. Supercritical is when you're producing too many neutrons. Subcritical is when you're not making enough to sustain power. So the word critical, it sounds like something that's bad in a nuclear reactor, but really when the reactor is critical, that means it's operating at a steady state power level.
So that sounds like that's coming from somebody who used to maintain nuclear power plants underwater.
A little bit.
The scariest thing in the world. It's kind of like people say DEFCON 1.
What's even more scary about that is when you're running drills and the captain just decides to come back for no reason and scram the reactor as you're operating underwater. That's the thing that should make you think.
Thorium can't go super critical.
It can't explode, I think, is what you're probably trying to say, right? It can't be used for weapons grade.
Yeah, I mean, you could with a lot of refinement. You could probably get it there. But at that point, you're putting more energy in the process than you are into probably your outcome.
Gotcha.
And you mix that with the new breeder reactors that they have now in SMRs. So I went on a rant about thorium, and I started off with saying, like, oh, let me say something. What's kind of funny, Chernobyl, and I stopped. I was like, don't want to describe Chernobyl as funny. But more people died from the air pollution in Kiev than died from the exposure to radiation at Chernobyl. The people who moved to the exclusionary zone outlived the people who moved to cities. 700,000 people a year die from hydrocarbon burning. We still need to do it. Like, we still, I get it, we need energy. But to pretend that nuclear is, like, more dangerous is just wild to me. It's just not.
I remember when I was in the power program school, they were talking about Greenpeace trying to catch them. And they were flying over doing radiation samples over an active coal plant and an active nuclear plant. Oh. They found zero radiation at the nuclear plant, and they found a bunch of radiation at the coal plant, which led them to the conclusion that the nuclear plant was a dummy and that the nuclear reactor was actually in the coal plant secretly.
Anybody listen to this, Google Dr. Roberts. He's a Nobel Prize winner in biology. He's the guy who figured out gene slicing. He's currently suing Greenpeace. I think he has about 80 to 100 Nobel laureates signed on trying to bring the founders of Greenpeace. Actually, the founders of Greenpeace became disillusioned with the movement and left because one of the products of Dr. Roberts' work was like why we have modern-day insulin. But it's also why we have something called golden rice, which is rice that is genetically modified to produce high levels of beta-carotene. So that's vitamin A, prevents blindness in children. So 20 million more blind children today because Greenpeace ran a smear campaign against...
GMOs.
Yeah. And yeah, so that's... those people are horrible actors and don't know anything about science. Never misunderstand someone. I had a professor in college tell me this who was the head of the USGS. He said, never mistake an environmentalist for somebody who's part of the green movement. Those are green movement's political, and environmentalism is a science. And they are two different things. It's like the people, I don't remember, back in the 70s, everybody wanted to plant trees in Africa to stop global warming. Africa has a burning season, which is why they don't want trees put in the Sahara, because that's a thing we have to deal with. So misinformation is a big thing in 2025 economics and in virtually everything else in life.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, so you got to work in Chernobyl somehow and do an economic end of year statement. That's kind of impressive.
It's the last thing I said actually before it was over.
What was the feedback though? What was the comments you're getting on it? People happy what you did?
I always think I'm horrible when I go up to these things. Like, I don't know what people want to hear. When I started my speech, I said, you know, one of the biggest compliments you can get as an economist is being asked to give an outlook. The biggest compliment you can get asked is to come back the next year.
Right.
So I was very positive. I got a lot of positive impact. The funniest one was somebody comes up to me and she says, I never laughed at during an economic outlook before. And I was like, and see, Kyle and I know each other too, so it's kind of like he knows my sense of humor. So I'm like, oh, I'm sorry it made you laugh. And she's like, no, I didn't mean it that way. I was like, I'm messing with you, man. Like, it's fine. I want you to laugh. I don't want you to fall asleep during it. Because here's the thing.
Yeah.
Guess what? No economic outlook can be an hour. An economic outlook would take days and days to fully brief. And there are excellent economists out there. I highly encourage everybody to read them, whether they're an Austrian like me, whether they're a Keynesian, whether they're, no matter what school they belong to, read them all. They're all brilliant, and they spend hours and hours and hours. My presentation probably took me, I probably did about 8 to 12 hours of work on it. Could have, if they had told me 2 hours, it would have been 14 hours. It would have been 24 hours of work. Like,
right.
As economists, we want to be translators. That's really what we want to be.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about some of the things that were in the report that you gave then. So you showed me kind of like an outlook or the overview of the presentation. One of the things that stuck out to me, I think, was inflation. That's something I think that's been on top of everyone's minds. I'm curious, how has inflation performed over like the last year, and then what's the outlook for next year?
Yeah, absolutely. So inflation's been tampered. That's how I would, it's been tampered down. Mm-hmm. And what's important to remember about inflation is that inflation is always inherently delayed. And when we talk about, we look at the market broadly with inflation. And for some of the people listening, I also have a chart up here. I'm going to do most of the narration just from an audio standpoint. So if somebody's like driving, listening to this, they have to get in a car accident looking at inflation chart.
But I am going to try to put this video on Spotify. So if you're listening on another app and you want to actually see the video, check out Spotify or YouTube.
So we gotta love Kyle. Actually, look at making up for my mistakes on stuff. one of my things I said in my 2024 outlook was that we have a soft landing, and we had a soft landing. And one of the metaphors I used during this year, the 2025 outlook, is what's a sign of a new driver? Kyle, you, I'm sure you taught your daughter how to drive. Like, they slam on the brakes and they get to a red light, right?
No. Not in my cars. You can do that in your own. Not in mine.
Yeah. Right. And I said, so an experience, a good Federal Reserve policy is going to ease on the brake and then stop at the red light. They're not going to slam on the brakes. So we don't want to see a sudden and abrupt rate cut. That's a bad signal to the market.
So is a 50 bip rate cut in the last cycle, then does that kind of worry you a little bit then? Because that seems a little aggressive, doesn't it?
See, I don't think that feels too aggressive.
No?
Okay. All right, this is where an economist and a finance expert will just start disagreeing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not realizing, Kyle, as I'm talking to you, I bet 50 basis points in your world feels like 1,000 pounds. That's actually pretty heavy.
It depends on if it's within expectations, I think. It's when they go and do something like that that's not being factored in. That's when they can cause a lot more fireworks.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that. Because in my world, a 10 basis point cut is so already baked into market trading that mm-hmm. it's immaterial. That is a good point. So, like, as economists, we always make decisions on the margin. So I want to see rate cuts that create marginal downward pressure. But right on, man. You are right. If you're a finance person, it would feel different.
Well, and I just talked to Vico about this, and we were talking specifically about the soft landing, inflation, and the Fed's decision to cut rates. And he was of the opinion that it was too soon to start cutting rates. Because if you get to the point where you actually need to cut them and you've already been doing it, like, what, you don't have any more ammo left in your bag. You're kind of out.
100% correct. That's what we talk about a lot. What's happening in China right now?
Yeah.
Is they're out of ammo. And ironically, in Russia, they're on the flip side of that. Though Russia is much different issues in Russia. Russia is radiation poisoning. If you ever want to see what radiation poisoning in economics looks like, they're dead. They just don't know it yet. The capital's gone in that economy. It will depreciate even if the war ended tomorrow and people capital started flowing back in.
It's so they're short already, the ruble. Is that what we're saying?
I mean, the ruble's down, 18-20% in the last month. With a 20%, so they have a 20%, 20.5% central bank rate, but they're still banks are loaning out at 8%. So the government's paying the difference between that.
Oh,
yeah, they'll be out of accessible foreign reserves probably by mid-2025.
Wow.
Yeah, it's what the sanctions we did in 2022. I wrote an op-ed. I forget who published it, to be honest with you, basically talking about the sanctions Russia got hit with basically put them back from in a capital position, mm-hmm. probably back to just before World War II.
Jesus.
Yeah, it's...
So what does that mean for Russia then? Is the country going to collapse then? I mean,
No, I don't think you'll see I don't think you'll see political collapse. I just think you'll see hyperinflation. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of foreign reserves. You'll probably see... It'll put pressure on them to get back trading with the rest of the world. What they were going to have to do is get access to the market and sell as much natural resources as I can to try and build that gap
right,
up.
Right.
Whether they'll be able to do it or not, I don't know. But this is very similar to when somebody gets exposed to radiation and now you don't have any more bone marrow. Like, it's
everything looks okay fine, for the first few. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So what? It was funny when I was going to do a 2024 recap, and mm-hmm. when I was going through. Talking to some of the guys who coordinate this, they were like, well, were you right? I go, of course, that's why I wanted to do the 2024 recap. If I wasn't right, I wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah, we skipped it.
Yeah, big well, hey, good economist is like a baseball player. You only got to be right 30% of the time to be in the Hall of Fame.
Right, right.
So inflation's tampering down. No, it's funny. We're at 2.7% our last data poll, which is fantastic. And what we're seeing is that the rate curve, we're not seeing inverted rate curves anymore, mm-hmm. or relatively not seeing them anymore. That's a really good sign. When you have stable inflation, sub 3% stable inflation, you have 2.8% real GDP growth, and you're mixing that with non-inverted yield curves. Do you know what we call that? We call that stability.
When you say inverted yield curves, you're talking about like the 2, the 5, and the 10-year bonds and the yields on those, or are you talking about something different?
Yeah, so I am. So what we do, and the little chart I have up here, it shows the 1 year, the 5 year, the 10 year, 20 year constant maturity
mm-hmm.
For a U.S. Treasury note or U.S. Treasury bond. It's all 1 year, so notes, securities. Let's just call them securities in general.
Okay.
On the investment basis, please, my dear friends, when you are looking up different rates for treasuries, everybody likes to use all this data, by the way, I'm referencing is from the Federal Reserve Economic Database, so this is from people far smarter than me. Don't be one of those guys who accidentally writes an entire article about Treasury Securities or one of those guys who trades on an article without looking at what their data is, you need to look at investment basis because that's what you're getting. That is the risk-free rate for Eric. That is the risk-free rate for Kyle. Mm-hmm. All right, we're not buying direct from the Treasury.
That's a good point. Look at
the investment basis. The amount of times I see spot basis and I see articles written on certain very, very good investment sites, and I listen to finance podcasts, and I'm like, I follow this data all the time because in my day job we sell a lot of bonds, mm-hmm. and so I have to know this. And I'm looking at it like, what you? You're trying to tell the guy with $20,000 in an investment account that's just trying to diversify that's what a treasury rate is? No. You got to be able to buy it. You got to look at the investment basis for it. That stabilization is fantastic. That stabilization is basically of yield curves is showing us that we have a real opportunity for a stable 2025.
So just looking at this chart right here. So which one is the blue line that starts on the bottom and flips to the top?
So that's the 1 year curve.
Okay.
So as you can see, it started underneath, but then around 2022, it went above, had all this weird drop down. That between September of 2022 and May of 2023 was a wild time to be in the market for bond sales. Just look at that. Just the 1 year was trading just so far above everything else. A lot of uncertainty. And you can actually see major political moments throughout the year. So you can actually see right when President Biden announced that he was not running again.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that. And then essentially since that date, we've been in a recovery period for 1 year. And so now we're back down to, we call this homogenization of rates, which is the precursor for returning to a non-inverted yield curve. And it's important for investors to know that when you see that precursor, and previously you were in an inverted environment, it's very unlikely to return to an inverted environment. There's so much market makers and so much market pressure that it's going to, you're going to go back to a normalized rate environment.
Okay.
But that's not to bury the lead in my last comment. We're looking at stability, what for? My best name slide of all time, which was taxes, Trump, tariffs, and trade.
Ooh, that's good alliteration.
Good alliteration, right?
good stuff. Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion on tariffs, and I don't understand how you can have a tariff that doesn't come back to the consumer. So I'm interested in this here.
Because you can't.
Okay.
Kyle, let me tell you something. Repairing power plants and nuclear submarines is far more advanced than tariffs. Tariffs are goofily simple. I've been very lucky in my life to be mentored by great economists. I'm very, very, very fortunate. I've had a lot of good people looking out for my very, very dumb ass throughout my entire career. So that'll be my one use of swear to my outlook. fun fact, I almost swore to my outlook last week because there was a hole on stage where all the equipment plugs into.
Yeah.
And they told me about it about four times. And when you listen to the recording, you'd hear air go up because I fell into the hole.
Is that as you're walking up or in the middle of it?
No, middle of it, behind the podium. Oh, so God. It looks like I just fell because they can't see it. They did let me walk around. I was on a lapel mic, so I got to do my Vanna White. I might go with the crowd. That might be my next time. Everybody organized it. It was amazing. So they told me it was there. They pointed it out to me, and it's neon white on the ground, and I fell in it. So that's on me. It's on me. It's my fault. tariffs. Nobody knows what's going to happen with tariffs, right? Because tariffs aren't the specific, right? Mm-hmm. You can specifically target a tariff to a good, to a nation, to a process. You can absolutely do that. But the economy decides. Markets decide who pays. And I love one of these quotes from one of my mentors, which is politics is an active but unwilling participant in economics. Politicians can say what they want, who pays what, but it is the market.
Mm-hmm.
My family owned a gas station for 75 years. I spent my childhood pumping gas. Gas tax. My family never paid a cent in gas tax.
Mm-hmm.
The consumer paid it because gas has very steep has a very steep demand curve for it. So what I want to do, if it's okay with Kyle here, I want to give people the tools on how to look at how tariffs are going to affect the market.
Okay.
All right. Before we do that, I just want to break up tariffs into three primary categories. The first is what we call a general tariff. That's a lot of what Donald Trump is talking about. They're broad tariffs directed toward an industry or adopted across all goods from a nation. When Trump talks about slapping tariffs on Canada, if Trump talks about put tariffs on Mexico, we would call this a general tariff.
That sounds more like a punitive one, though.
Well, here's where it gets different. First off, as an economist, I view all tariffs as punitive.
Fair enough.
I feel that was like a plug for Austrianism right there.
Right, yeah.
What punitive tariffs are, is that they're meant to change the second type, like Kyle just mentioned, is punitive tariffs. They're meant to change behavior of a nation. So putting a tariff on Mexico to stem immigration flow or to stop drug flow would be a punitive tariff.
Mm-hmm.
If you just put the tariff on all agricultural goods, it's a general tariff. If you're trying to get them to change a behavior, use it as a stick, then we call it a punitive tariff.
Okay.
And then the last one, and this is the most interesting type of tariff. There's a bunch of different names for it. So I'm going to use the term a therapeutic tariff. If you Google that, you may get a different answer. But the broad concept of a therapeutic tariff is you're using it to correct an equilibrium. It's a medicinal tariff.
So is this more like the ones you talked about where, like, if the government starts subsidizing an industry and bringing the price down too much, then, yeah, we'll tariff it to get it more on equal playing ground.
Bingo. Absolutely. Hey, Kyle,
I'm learning.
It's not learning if you already have all the answers, Kyle.
Well, because you told me a couple weeks ago.
Please help. My students are taking their final this week, so I hope they also say that.
Actually, send me. You know what? That'd be fun. Send me the final. I'll take it.
I'll send you the final.
Yeah, I'll try to take it and see how bad it is. I'll be the curve then. The guy.
Would bet almost any money that you would get at least a 90 on it. If you actually sat down and took it seriously,
without
studying for it, I bet you'd get an idea on it. Your intuition on this stuff. If you don't outthink yourself,
mm-hmm.
like it's one of those things. It's like 50 questions. If you took 50 minutes to do it, you get a higher grade than if you took 3 hours to do it.
Oh, I'm doing this. I love taking tests. I don't know why I'm weird like that, but
I love taking tests too. That's probably why I get along.
So, tell your class I'm going to be the curve they're rated against.
You all have to listen to the show so you can try and guess where Kyle's going to fall on this. So therapeutic tariffs are the EV industry, but nothing new's under the sun, like they say in Elasticles, all right? Because we did this to Airbus to protect Boeing.
We did this with steel a lot too, don't we? Have we done it in the past?
So steel's very weird. So steel's had therapeutic tariffs, but they've also had general tariffs. It was earlier in the 2000s, they passed a steel tariff that saved a few hundred jobs, I believe, in U.S. Steel, but it cost like 1,200 jobs in microbreweries because the cost of kegs went through the roof. tariffs never make something better. Even a therapeutic tariff means we pay more for electric cars, but it more fits them. It equalizes the market back to equilibrium and therefore creates sustainability in the long run. So in the long run, it's better.
Mm-hmm.
There are no producers. There are no consumer tariffs. So this is the cheat sheet for anybody on how to measure the effect of tariffs. So you have two markets,
mm-hmm.
economically sensitive markets and economically insensitive markets. So if the demand for your good is very shallow, which is what we see here, that means as people are very price sensitive to that.
This is like your luxury goods or your wants versus needs.
Bingo, buddy. Absolutely. Gotcha. Right on, Kyle. In this environment, so we're looking, right now I have up a chart that shows a price of $10 a good, $11 a good, and we're going to show what happens if a $5 tariff is put on top of it, bringing the price to $16.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're at equilibrium, you can express that, and there's a green rectangle on screen right here, and that represents the whole market. For all our finance guys, the market is just price times quantity. That's revenue, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's revenue, right?
Money, baby.
Yes, correct. that product can be expressed as your entire market, the price times quantity. Now, if we take that same logic and we apply price to quantity for your after the tariff. The price went up, mm-hmm. but the market shrunk considerably. Now, what's interesting here is that a lot of this tariffs, then that extra $5 isn't even part of your portfolio, right? Mm. You pay that. You have to pay that to the government. So who pays it? In economically sensitive markets, it's paid by the producer. The producer ends up absorbing most of it. It still restricts the amount of supply in the supply of a good because there's less demand for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no incentive to produce beyond the demand for a good. You'll end up incurring a loss. So it shrinks the market. So if you're fortunate enough to be watching the video on here, the rectangle where the light blue, which is the this is at the market after tariffs, and the green market before tariffs, that overlapping space is essentially the production of the market, for more or less. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that light blue area, that's going to the government because the government's collecting a tariff. So the market's shrunk quite considerably because of these tariffs. And that's economically sensitive. Your wants are going to be more or less resilient to this.
What does the government do with that money?
What is the Trump administration going to do? Probably try and close a massive deficit. Big, big, big deficit. The biggest deficits we've had outside of the pandemic since World War II.
Makes sense. Okay. So I could see their reasoning maybe for wanting to collect a little more income, because there's probably more appetite to throw a tariff on something just because people don't understand them than there is to increase taxes.
That's probably 100% exactly what's happening. You may have just completely deduced out. Yes, that's basically what's happening. Plus, there's also this thing about if you're taxing like expensive wines, does that hurt the economy?
Probably not as much. I mean, well, it's expensive wines versus like grapes. I think one is much more far-reaching. You have a much bigger market for grapes than you do for expensive wine, right? So probably the size of the market has to do with?
Yes. Kyle, that's actually an excellent point. Okay. So utility of the underlying product, like taxing steel pellets versus taxing, you know, I-beams, would have a different effect.
Yeah.
Now, in economically insensitive markets, so these are markets where the demand, these are the needs. So and this will never believe I ever decided to run for office, which hopefully I'll never do that. I believe the clip any of my opponents will use, which when I was up on stage, I said, if you want an effective tax, you should tax insulin. and a couple people in the audience know I have type 1 diabetes and I use insulin. They're understanding I'm saying this in jest.
Facetiously? Yeah.
Yes. That I'm saying it, saying like, oh, I'm going to pay whatever I need for my insulin because it's my insulin. All costs come after that. The other 145 people in the audience, I very quickly had explained to them I have type 1 diabetes, and I was making a kind of a joke.
Can you imagine those people walking out of there? Our government wants to tax insulin? Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was... I got a good chuckle after that. They all were like, he's trying to be funny. It's a little nervous on that one. So if you're taxing gasoline or you're taxing different, you know, energy sources, agricultural products, you're going to end up with the consumer paying the vast majority of that, because why would the firm want to lose money?
Yeah. I think the gas tax was a perfect example. Everybody needs gas. Nobody's going to stop buying gas because you increase the tax. They may limit the amount of consumption. They may try to reduce that, but they're still going to have to pay for your product.
Yeah. But in both situations, tariff prices are raised. In both situations, consumers pay more. Mm-hmm. And bringing it back real quick to inflation, to loop this all around, is that we currently conduct Mexico and the U.S., we're the largest trade partners.
Yeah, recently overtook China.
Yeah, $855.1 billion in trade. Yeah. Between U.S., Mexico, and Canada, it's $1.8 trillion in trade. And Trump wants to put tariffs on both of those. Which, again, you can't... I understand, by the way, how hypocritical it sounds when I say you can't predict the outcome of tariffs, and then I'm trying to predict the outcomes of tariffs. I'm very aware of that. So please know I'm talking about this as, like, markets in a Cartesian plane. I don't want anybody to think that this is some sort of exact specification on what is going to happen. Mm-hmm. But I want to point something out here. All right, so if we look at trade between Mexico and the U.S., all right... trade between Mexico, U.S., and Canada. If we look at trade between the U.S. and Canada, the trade has grown since 2021 the trade has increased about the same as it did between 1995 and 2020, just in the course of a couple of years. Mexico, a little less prominent, but still, you know, large increase since 2020, about an increase between the same increase you saw between 2008 and 2020.
When was NAFTA signed?
That was under Clinton, so that would have been the mid-90s.
Which would explain that's when the ramp all starts up.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
Yeah,
look
funny,
at,
huh?
Look at that. Wow, yeah, look at that one right there. Right? That's crazy between U.S. and Canada. Now, inflation usually leads off things like energy price and food. So if we're going to throw energy and food are both very economically insensitive markets, which means the consumer pays for them. Would you like to guess what the largest export of Mexico to the U.S. is?
Probably something like oranges or avocados.
Agricultural goods.
Yeah.
Yeah, so groceries. Yeah. And the largest export between Canada and the U.S. is?
Maple syrup.
100%. Vermont's yeah, fighting Vermont, that one. No. our old buddy Joel, who we now are under contract to reference every single show I'm on, because I love Joel.
It's oil and maple syrup, nothing else.
Only viscous fluids.
Yes.
A bad joke. I'm sorry, Kyle. You deserve better for me than that.
I actually really enjoyed that one.
So, energy. It's energy byproducts. Mm-hmm. So, if you're expecting inflation, or let's just say the cost of living, since core inflation usually retracts out stuff like energy and food costs, which, it, by the way, that gets crapped on a lot. It does it for a good reason, because those are such sensitive ones that if we're trying to observe an effect over a very, very long time, mm-hmm. increasing volatility does not help that type of data. But please don't be mistaken that economists aren't looking at data like that. Just because we don't reference it in our most commonly referenced CPI, we still observe that data.
Mm-hmm.
Where is this? Who is going to pay for these 20% tariffs and insensitive economic markets if you're increasing the cost of importing energy and importing food?
Yeah.
The consumer in the U.S. That's who's paying for it.
Yep. That was my fear.
Like, it's...
Sorry, go back to that. What was that? What is autarky?
All right, so autarky is when an economy is completely self-sufficient in terms of economics. And it's a term, I can tell you, I don't really watch news. Like, I don't watch cable news.
Yeah, no, neither.
I just think it must be long. I watch local news. I like to hear what's going on. And like any local news channel, occasionally do national stories. And I'm making my little, I have celiac disease, so I'm making like some crappy gluten-free waffles in the morning. And I hear in the other room.
Sorry.
Kyle's been out to eat with me a few times, so he knows the process it is to do anything with me when it involves food. It's like
I don't know what gluten is, but it is necessary.
it is the only reason things taste good.
Yes.
But yeah, it's like an angry people are like, I'm gluten-free. And I'm like, oh, do you have celiac disease? They're like, no. I'm like, then you're not. You're just.
Yeah. You're just weird.
Yeah. Why is that your personality? Like, I'm a weird guy. So even I'm told me to judge you. But so autarky is the concept of being economically self-sufficient. And what I always say is any economy in the world can, any nation can enter autarky. Any nation in the world can enter autarky. How far back to cavemen would you like to go is the question.
Yeah.
You just want to be nomadic people running around North Korea. You have no problem doing that. But if you want to have cell phones and you want to have nice cars and you want things to be affordable and you want to have all these nice things, you're going to have to trade.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that comes up is, why do we have to trade? We're the United States. We're the most powerful country on earth. We have all these resources. I shouldn't have to trade with anybody. And I'm saying, you don't have to. If you want nice things, you could probably go back to like 1991. The U.S. probably have 1991 technology, never have to talk to anybody ever again. Which is probably the best of anybody else in the world if we all just decided trading's not going to happen anymore.
For now, but how long is that going to last?
I don't know. I'm very curious. I fell down the rabbit hole of how we used to do, like, before you started having really, like, before Moore's Law went through the roof ability to write for, like, microprocessors and stuff like that.
Just still holding up, by the way, which is insane.
Yeah, yeah. That's, by the way, we thought that was going to stop, but apparently... It's not.
Transistors are the width of atoms now, or like they're approaching that length. Like,
yeah, now
the reason why it's holding true now is because they're stacking them now. So they're stacking transistors
they're making them
to get the same density. Yeah.
Kyle, that's fascinating.
It is. It's crazy.
I always thought the drive to quantum computing was going to be heavily influenced by us just, you can't make it any smaller than an atom.
Mm-hmm. Well, quantum computing still has some major limitations where I don't know that it's necessarily going to be the... It's got some great computational abilities because of the way it can calculate multiple states, but the speed of it doing other stuff that traditional PCs, it's still got a long ways to go to catch up to that.
Yeah, I don't know if quantum computing will ever replace like a PC or a cell phone, but in terms of, like you said, computational stuff, it's untouchable. But yeah, it's not like you're not going to be watching, you're not going to be playing like Words with Friends on a quantum computer.
Right. No, you're getting the answer to what the question to 42 is.
So the idea of America First, that it, you know, is talked about a lot in, and this is some stuff that actually I've heard from people they want included in my outlook. What does that mean? What is that autarky? And it's fun to say that word. I love every 4 years. By the way, an economist giving an outlook during an election year is the Olympic stars. Oh, that is like one of the best compliments. It autarky is not tariffs. It is not trade deficit reducing measures and stuff like that. Autarky is the complete shutdown of trade. But why do we need trade? Well, here's the thing. Can the U.S. outproduce Mexico in everything from microwaves to supercomputers to new cars? Of course it can. It absolutely... The might of the U.S. manufacturing economy, which has been depreciated, but we can't understate our ability to innovate. Every U.S. worker has over $140,000 of capital behind them. That's why U.S. workers are so expensive. We have the best secondary education system in the world. That's
why this doesn't work, though, is because you don't have enough people who are willing to work for lower wages to produce the little shit that everybody wants.
Bingo. Yeah. You want an iPhone, but you don't want an iPhone that costs $75,000.
Right.
So we have an absolute advantage. But do we have a comparative advantage in trade? And this is fun. Hmm. What I love about election seasons is I teach Econ 201. And during election seasons, I get to teach Econ 201 to everybody who walks to my office and asks me a question about the election. This comparative advantage, Mexico can make things cheaper. And that's the beauty of trade. Mexico, before, you know, onshoring started happening, was losing jobs. Had a deficit in its manufacturing sector. And what happens? U.S. companies put capital into Mexico. Mexican workers are now more productive because they have more capital behind them. That's how the production function works. They have more capital behind them. They make more money. The U.S. consumer gets a cheaper good. So the U.S. consumer is paying a lower price, and the Mexican worker is making more money. That's called a Lewis model, by the way. Won a Nobel Prize by my favorite economist, Sir Dr. Arthur Lewis. And everybody's better off. Economics is not capitalism is not a zero-sum game. Somebody doesn't have to lose for somebody else to win. In that situation, the Mexican worker is better off and the U.S. consumer is better off. And the U.S. worker, who has a lot more capital behind them, can now go make Teslas, can now go with those made in China, but can now go assemble Fords.
Right, or something else that's higher level of complexity where that money is better put to use.
And now that worker is making more money because he'd make more money building a Ford than building a microwave. And now he has more money in his pocket. And there's a higher value of good produced. So the U.S. economy has higher GDP. Agrarian versus making microwaves in Mexico, microwaves are much higher value-added process. Now Mexico's GDP is higher. And now there's more taxes. Those same taxes can go to funnel education systems. Can you see why the Soviet Union didn't work?
Right, but the scary side of that is that you can't have an entire world of the United States then. It just feasibly would not work like that.
Oh, but can you?
Can you? I don't know.
Can you? Let me ask you a question. This is a question I've been asked multiple times, Kyle. That's why I like this question.
Yeah.
Do we still have cavemen walking around?
Yeah.
So are those products of economics?
I wouldn't call it products of economics necessarily. I think that's just... They just are. I don't know.
If you some people
don't. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. You're asking the right question, Kyle. That's why I want to walk down this road with you. If you isolate somebody from global trade, do they develop? Does that economy develop?
No.
No.
Free trade is what allows the transfer of ideas and that allows all that new tech and everything to spread to everywhere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If we had an example of incubation inside isolationism, that would be much different. Then I would honestly say, Kyle, you may be right. Here's where I take a little bit of a different thesis on this. A rising tide lifts all boats. So can every country be a first world country? I honestly think they can be if each country specializes in something. I mean, if a country specializes in one form of manufacturing.
Yeah.
I don't know. If you're if you're a country on the island of Formos, and you're really good at making designing really, 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 really tiny schematics for things that go inside your cell phone, can you become wealthy?
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
You do, because, and you can do it for cheaper because you're specialized, and that's where specialization is powerful. So yeah, I believe you can have a world. I believe with true capitalism, capitalism that's not cronyism. I hate the there's no Truth Scottman argument. Don't get me wrong, but I'm saying like capitalism where politics doesn't get too involved. No, everybody can be wealthier. You can have one country that's really good at producing one thing, another country that's really good at producing another thing, and they trade. Both people are better off because they both got the good for cheaper.
Okay. All right. I'll listen to the economist on that. It's just something that's always been kind of going around the back of my head. Is if you need somebody to take the lower paying jobs to do the work that we don't want to do, then we're always going to need somebody willing to do that work, right?
Yeah, but then we can, if we have more capital, put in there suddenly like with an ATM. That was one of my things in my Outlook. I talked about this like with AI. There's more people, there's more bank tellers. There's twice as many bank tellers today as there was when the first ATM came out, because ATM now is doing the crappy part of the job.
Oh.
And now that ATM worker, that teller, is more valuable because they have more capital, so they're doing the more complicated stuff. And now there's a job for some tradesman who's smart enough to know how to repair an ATM.
Right.
So, and the bank robber doesn't have to hurt anybody when they want to rob a bank. No, check it out. It's going really into gray markets.
I like it.
I'm proud of that joke, huh?
I like it. Okay, now you make a good point, man. I think I'll see that one to you. Anything else from the Outlook, or where's it going to be at where people can listen to it? When's it going to be available?
So, the company that hosts it, they'll put out something very, very shortly. But if you go on, Gray and Associates, just Google them in 2020.
Gray, like Dorian Gray?
G-R-A-Y.
A-Y.
Yeah.
I think we made that joke last time.
I want to spell it G-R-E-Y. Anytime I see the word gray,
yeah.
I don't know why my brain goes to that spelling of it.
Because that's the way it's supposed to be spelled. That's the color.
I'm trying to think how I spell the color, but I don't know the last time I wrote the word gray. I don't think they're both acceptable in English. I think you're right, Kyle. I think you're 100% right on this.
I think there's only one, but yeah, I'm trying to remember a Crayola crown. I'm pretty sure it's an E.
Actually the best way to do that. But yeah, so take a look. If anybody wants to listen to it, it's about, the Q&A was pretty fun. But our 15 of your time, you can hear my unprofessional ramblings about different economic forces and
laughing at Chernobyl. And
I was bad. That was laughing at Chernobyl and suggesting to tax insulin. Both said in jest, for the record. That was both hyperbole for the sake of learning, but nonetheless, we'll get. They came up to me afterwards, like, "Do you want to edit that out?" And I was like, "Nah, not at all." I said it. It's not on them. That's not fair. Because, again, these guys are professionals. They're so polite on this stuff that they want to be respectful. I'm like, no, it's my fault for saying it. I hope people got the point I was trying to make.
Did the joke land? Extremes. That's the question I would have asked.
No, it landed. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, leave it. Got it. If it didn't land, then you can cut it.
Yeah. I don't want people thinking I'm smarter than I am.
Right. All right. Well, I think that's probably going to be enough economic lessons for today. We'll be back soon after I've taken a test, I think, here. Maybe we'll reconvene after the new year and see how I end up scoring on that. It's going to be fucking hilarious, I think. Maybe I'll see if somebody else like Rick wants to do it, too.
Yeah, send it around. I'll grade them all.
I freaking love that. All right. Thank you all for sticking around to the end here with us, me and Erica. Remember, you can show our panelists some love. Click on the links in the show notes. I'll have the website up there where the YouTube video will get posted, or where the video will get posted. It won't be up there immediately, but it'll be there. Just keep checking. I'll get it on there eventually. We'll be back soon with another exciting episode. Hopefully with more PowerPoint presentations than last week. But until then, have a great week. Enjoy the holidays, all that good stuff. This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only, does not constitute financial or investment advice, and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations.
Produced by China Shop Productions.